Hello everyone, welcome to J-Talk Extra Time. My name's John Steele. I've been away for a little while. It feels like a lot has taken place, a lot has happened since then. With me as a guest this week is Stuart Smith. Stu, how are you doing?
Whoa, did you just refer to me as a guest?
Yeah, is that okay?
Look at that. I thought I was the co-host, not a guest on here, but I'm very good. And it's good to have you back, actually. Yeah, it's been a while since we've spoken together, right?
Very much so. Just to be clear, that being a guest means you don't have to edit anything, Stu. It's actually a good...
Blinding. Oh, wonderful. I'm very happy to be your guest. Very
you
happy.
Just slump back on, you know, slump your head over the desk when we're finished and leave it all to me. Really good to talk to you, man. And thanks so much for all your hard work, looking after the pod in July. For various reasons, work went a bit bonkers for me. Back there, so yeah, good to have you. Good to have you sort of holding the reins and keeping things ticking over. If I'm not mixing too many metaphors early doors. So, Stu, what we're going to do for the listeners in this episode, we don't have any match action from J2 to review per se because we're on our kind of accursed Olympic break at the moment, aren't we? For another week or so. So what I thought we'd do is just for the first part of the show, we'll talk about the J2 season so far, what we've made of it in very general terms. We've got lots of transfer news to talk about as well, haven't we, from the summer transfer window? So we'll mention that too. Then we'll take a quick break and we'll come back and preview again, pretty broad brushstrokes, what we think will happen in the remainder of the season, and talk about some pretty troubling news coming out of Tokyo Verde as well in the last few hours. If that sounds all right, Stu, we'll get straight into it. We've played 23 rounds of J2 action, haven't we? This is not us, obviously, the professionals. 19 rounds left. What have you made of things so far in broad terms?
I think it's turning into a typical J2 season with lots of action at the top and at the bottom. I think the bottom is going to be just an almighty like free for all, just because of the double relegation places this year with four teams going down. I think I'm surprised it's stayed so tight at the top, and I think that's due to the fact that there isn't particularly one standout team, and the teams at the top are all capable of taking points off each other. I think the wild card that has been thrown in is Montedio Yamagata, who have just kind of rampaged through their schedule since Peter Klamowski took over. I wonder if the break in the schedule will help them, as in it'll give them a break and it'll help them reload and retool. We'll go through a couple of their signings later on, or if it's bad for them because it just snaps that momentum. But I think for the second half of the season, Montero Yamagata are the wild card in the promotion race, because up until this point they've been just sparkling. They've just played some great football, and yeah, it's going to be. It goes without saying, it's going to be an exciting finish to the season, and I don't see any one team running away with it. I think we're going to have a tightly packed maybe three or four team promotion race come the end of the season.
Yeah, I think you're right to point out Yamagata as a potential sort of bolter into the top two. Just looking at the table in front of me now, their record only 5 defeats so far. That's the same as second place the Iwata, isn't it? And their goal difference, Yamagata's goal difference is plus 12. That's only one goal less than Iwata. Obviously, 6 points worse off at the moment, but with still 19 games to play, when we come back, that could evaporate. And of course, in the last round before the break, Yamagata did win away at Iwata, didn't they? So yeah, it's exciting stuff. Where do you think, I'm going to channel the my inner Ben Maxwell here, Stu? Where can we draw the line in terms of realistic promotion challenges? Just as a reminder for everyone listening, only the top two will get promoted to J1 this year. You know, there are 2 automatic promotion places, no playoffs, as a kind of hangover from the sort of COVID affected season last year. So how far down can we go? We've got Yamagata in 6th place, 6 points off the top two. Machida Zelvia, 1 point and 1 place further back on 41. And again, Nagasaki in 8th on 40, obviously with a very very impressively assembled squad. What are we thinking? My gut feeling is 8th place Nagasaki on 40 points. That's as far down as we should be looking for promotion, realistic promotion contenders. Would you go along with that?
Yeah, I would. I think it's kind of it's a very natural border, to be quite honest. Then the top eight teams, they all have their good points. Like in one-off games against each other, it's going to be difficult to pick winners because obviously Montedio have done the double over Jubilo. We saw Kyoto and Niigata drawing. We've seen UQ beat some of the other teams in the top eight. And so I think that if you draw the line under Viva and Nagasaki in eighth place, I think I would be stunned if the top two teams don't come out of that eight. So yeah, I'd draw it at eighth place, Nagasaki.
Okay, we're in agreement. Yeah, I think, obviously at the moment we've got Kyoto and Iwata as the top two, 48 points each. They sort of refusing to be separated, aren't they? But I do sense that there could be, one of the teams from outside that top two now could sneak in either. I think Kyoto, for me, just look a bit more solid, maybe a bit more consistent. But Iwata, if they wobble, yeah, there is a team that could maybe sneak in and take their place. Even, of course, perennial fifth place, Kofu, they've only lost four times, haven't they? Niigata as well, who I think if we separate the season into quarters, and in the first quarter of this season, Niigata, obviously the standout team, weren't they? They've only lost four times as well. So, yeah, we'll see. Also, their goal difference is absolutely mega, isn't it? Plus 24, helped by that 7-0 thrashing of Tokyo Verdy. I can't stop talking about Verdy. That's not a new thing, I suppose. Okay, so I think we're basically, I think we've covered all the key points, sort of in the top eight, the top third of the table. Stu, what about at the bottom? You mentioned already it's going to be a pretty hectic relegation dogfight. So again, just as a reminder, for anyone like me who's taken a month off, four relegation places for the first time ever in J2. So that kind of explains why it's going to be an almighty scrap. We've got Sagamihara rock bottom, and then kind of in ascending order, Omiya still second bottom, Ehime, Kitakyushu, they're in the relegation zone right now. Gunma, Tochigi, Matsumoto, Yamaga just outside. What do you make of that kind of morass of mediocre teams at the bottom, Stu? And again, where can we draw the line in terms of who should be very nervous looking over their shoulders going into the second half?
It's an interesting one, this, because there's a natural cutoff line at Matsumoto Yamaga. So Matsumoto Yamaga are on 22 points, and then there's a 4-point gap to a cluster of teams, Renofa, Tsuegen Kanazawa, and Okayama, I think. I think the bottom seven are in trouble, but I also think that one of the teams above the bottom seven is going to slip into trouble as well. And that's why it's a little bit difficult to say where the line is. I think that, yeah, possibly Blau-Blitz Akita might be the line, actually. Because, yeah, like I said to you before we started recording, like Yamaguchi, Kanazawa, and Okayama at various stages of the year have been quite dreadful in parts. And it only takes another one of those kind of disastrous runs of form to be sucked into the relegation battle. The teams below them, I mean, I am starting to get a little bit worried about Omiya. I think they've done a bit of decent business in the summer window, which we'll come on to later. I think that it wouldn't surprise me any of those bottom seven teams getting relegated. Even Matsumoto Yamaga, like they look dreadful. Like they look woefully unbalanced. They've got Nanami in charge now, but I don't know what he brings to the table, and I don't know where kind of Matsumoto Yamaga are gonna look to get out of this. They've just brought in Serginho, previewing the transfer news later on. But yeah, those bottom seven teams, like, it wouldn't surprise me if any of those went down. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about Sagamihara. Obviously, they're rock bottom, as usual, we can say, but they're only 2 points behind Omiya, although we should say Sagamihara are let's see, I'm doing maths in my head, it's going to take a while. They're five points away from safety, aren't they, Sega Mihara? Can we say, do you think their goose is cooked, it's a done deal? I just can't see them, obviously 5 points is only a win and two draws, but I just can't see Sega Mihara getting out of it, to be honest. And then Olmi are only 2 points better off. So if I say that a team on 16 points is doomed, I'm finding it hard to be positive about a team that's only 2 points better off. And Olmi, we should say, 3 wins from 23 matches. I mean, it's pretty pathetic. I think with Sega Mihara's squad, they've actually done 3 wins from 23 is not too bad considering their squad, I don't think. I think we talked about it at the time. They very harshly sacked their manager, didn't they, earlier on? Whereas Olmi are 3 wins from 23 matches with the players available. It's pretty dismal stuff. And like you said, some transfer business we'll come on to is perhaps given them one of their transfers gives me a lot of hope. One of them left me scratching my head, but we'll come on to that. I don't know. I think Sega Mihara, I just can't see them getting out of it. Olmi, my head says that there are just too many good players in their squad for them to go down. But the evidence in front of us is that that's not really working, is it?
You know what's interesting about Sega Mihara is that their first game after the summer break is at home to Tochigi. And then after that, they've got Kofu, Niigata and Iwata in consecutive weeks. My gut feeling says that if they don't get a win, if they lose against Tochigi, then it's going to be quite a difficult rest of August for Sega Mihara. So I think they've got a huge game on August the 9th against Tochigi to focus on. And yeah, Olmia, I was confident when Masahiro Shimoda was brought in, and he does seem to have turned it around. He made them a little bit harder to beat. I think what they've drawn 4 of the last 5 or something like that. Their only defeat in the last 6 against Yamagata, and that's no disgrace at all. But they come out of their break away at Niigata, which is a difficult game. But then they've got a run of, hesitate to say winnable games, but they've got Akita, Okayama, Matsumoto, Tokyo Verde, and then Ehime. So by the end of August, we should have a decent handle on where both Sega Mihara and Olmi are in relation to like their survival hopes. So, yeah, I mean, you've just got to hope that teams are actually doing worthwhile stuff in this summer break. Now, whether that means resting a lot and saving up energy for the battles to come, I can see that. Whether that means extra training or bringing in new players, then each team to their own or whatever. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting kind of opening salvo after the summer break ends.
Yeah, these are good points. It's much too hot to be running around at the moment. So I hope they're resting. Hope some players are resting like me. Yeah, I played football last week and it was a very bad idea. I think just before we talk about some of the other relegation threatened teams, I think for Sega Mihara, we've probably made the point in previous pods, but it's definitely worth repeating. 12 goals scored in 23 matches. If they can't improve on that, then they're not going to even, you know, make it off the bottom, are they? 12 goals from 23 games is it's not gonna cut it, not gonna do it. Olmi are much better off, aren't they? 21 goals scored. That is, at least there's a platform for them to build on if they can, as you say, just build up some momentum, which they've not been able to do yet, even with the new manager in charge. Worst defense in the division, I think, is the third bottom team, isn't it? Ehime, 41 goals conceded, despite having the loudest shouting goalkeeper, probably, in the form of Yota Akimoto. So Ehime, Kita Kyushu, Gunma, we mentioned Tochigi a little bit as well. Do you think there's any Ehime, they got much chance of getting out of it, or Kita Kyushu, or should they be very worried?
Well, I think they should all be very worried, but again, like, the teams are going to have to play each other. So I think there's a lot of six-pointers on the schedule coming forward. So in essence, you can probably, if you're one of those teams, you can probably lose against the Kyotos or Jubilos or Montedio Yamagatas of the world, as long as you beat the teams immediately around you, because not only do you gain 3 points yourself, but you take away the potential 3 points of your opponents. And so I think it'll be the teams that kind of focus their minds on beating the teams around them that will make hay. And I think that, but having said that, again, I just go back to my original answer that any of those bottom seven teams, like if you shuffled a bag and pulled out any four at random, I could easily think, oh yeah, that seems reasonable. If it was Gunma, Tochigi, Matsumoto, and Ehime, I'd look at it and think, yeah, fair enough. Like, I don't have a problem with that. And so I think that it's very difficult to say which teams might go on a run. They're down there for a reason, and being high on confidence is not a reason that they're down there. So yeah, it's difficult to say.
I think something that occurred to me, and we'll move on probably after making this point, but something which has seemed like a hindrance for Kita Kyushu in the first half of the season, which is the amount of youth players, or youngsters they have in the team. I think as we get to the business end, where a lot of players are going to be tired, I wonder if that could be a positive for them, you know, having more willing runners or you know, younger, like fresher legs in the team. I might be clutching at straws a little bit, but I just wonder if, you know, you look at Ehime's squad is pretty old, Gunma's squad, Tochigi's squad, Matsumoto's squad, all players who they might have the experience, but I think physically, I'm not sure, none of these teams has looked physically in great shape, you know, in the first half of the season. So I think for Kita Kyushu, although they've been very brittle at times, especially at home, I think, and they're also a team that needs to, they really need to score more goals than they have done in the first 23 rounds. I think the fact that they have so much youth to call upon, I think that is something that could stand them in good stead going into a sort of relegation run-in. But I've been wrong before, Stu, many times, so we'll have to wait and see how it pans out. And yeah, I'm not sure. I think Akita will probably just about be okay, which I think is where you are as well. But I think my line would be, yeah, maybe that bottom seven. I think Okayama, Kanazawa, Yamaguchi, none of them are teams that you would, with apologies to fans of those teams listening, I don't think you would maybe choose to watch. But I think by hook or by crook, they'll get enough points to just about be okay. I think our four relegation teams are going to come from the bottom seven that we have right now. So, well, let's move on and talk about some transfer news then, Stu. We foreshadowed that a little bit by mentioning Serginho coming back in at Matsumoto Yamaga. So I always, every summer transfer window, I do my best to keep on top of the transfers, and I'm okay for the first day or two, and then there's this like deluge of players moving around, and I just can't keep track. So do you have a sort of top three or top five big transfers I need to make sure that I've got on my list? Which moves have surprised you or raised your eyebrows?
I think the first one that raised my eyebrows was Fukushima United forward Ismaila moving to Kyoto Sanga. I'm not denying that Ismaila is a good player at J3 level and definitely has the potential to improve. He's got he's still only young, 21 or 20, 22, I think scored a decent amount of goals in J3 for Fukushima, but I think it's a luxury signing, because I don't think he comes into the side and improves that side. He's not going to dislodge Peter Utaka. He's probably not going to dislodge Miyayoshi, who's still there. Is it Miyayoshi? Yeah. And they've still got plenty of other attacking options as well. That raised my eyebrows a bit, but I think it's a signing that has potential to pay off in the future. Because, to be honest, if you are going to learn from someone as a forward in the J League, you might as well learn from Peter Utaka. He scored 50 goals for Kyoto Sanga now. So, I don't expect that to pay off immediately. But I think in the long run, I think that's a pretty astute kind of bit of scouting from Choki J. I think Jubilo have actually done some really good business. I think their business has to be viewed in the context of selling Hiroki Ito, their central defender, to VfB Stuttgart in Germany. And so that was kind of difficult to see how they were going to replace him. But they've brought in, who have they brought in? Ryo Takano, the left back or wing back or midfielder from Yokohama F. Marinos. They brought in Makito Ito, who was at Marinos as well, but he played mostly at Mito Hollyhock the last couple of years, who's a relatively decent central defender. And they also brought in Shota Kanako from Shimizu S-Pulse, who's a really, really good J1 level player, in my opinion. And for Jubilo to get him to play alongside Hiroki Yamada, Yasuhito Endo, Kotaro Omori, to provide the bullets for Lukian and their stable strikers, I think they've done some really good business. I think they've strengthened. It was potentially, it had negative connotations by selling Hiroki Ito, but they've gone and they've said, yeah, we sold one, but we've brought in three other very decent players as well. So those are the ones really that shape the top two. What do you think about those moves?
Yeah, I think Ismaila is an interesting one. I'm not really sure where he fits in, other than I think he might displace Ryosuke Noda as the sort of beanpole striker on the bench who needs three or four chances to convert a goal. But yeah, I didn't realise Ismaila's nickname was Kaká, and I'm not really sure where that comes from, because I don't think it's anything to do with the Brazilian midfield maestros. They're not similar players at all. So whether it's one of his names or not, but all the Fukushima United fans had these flags saying thank you Kaká, goodbye Kaká. Yeah, unless they're confused, they've mixed him up with somebody else. But yeah, it is worth watching the highlights of his last game for Fukushima, isn't it, Stu? Because he scores in the 94th minute with an assist from the Imabari goalkeeper, Tomohito Shugyo, that he will probably not want to see again. But yeah, it's a weird move in the sense that attack didn't seem to be an area that needed strengthening. And the point that you've made, and I think Magic Mike Innes has mentioned as well, I'm not sure if bringing in Ismaila does strengthen that squad particularly, but it's a good option to have, I suppose. Iwata, I think that move with Hiroki Ito moving out kind of caught me and a few other people by surprise. I wasn't really, didn't see that coming. Or I think my opinion of Jubilo is still very heavily weighted towards the first few games of the season. It's very hard to imagine any of the defenders from those games getting game time in Europe. But they did tighten up, and they have been very impressive, I think, over the first half of the season as a whole. So I think, yes, like you said, to sell one player and bring three new players in is good business. I've mentioned as well, they still have their Romanian Moldovan goalkeeper, who's not been in the matchday squad yet, and I can't remember his name. So I think there's a possibility. I actually think is it Ryuki Mura? Is a really good keeper.
Yes.
So I don't suppose that's an area where they're in any trouble. But yes, Iwata have strengthened for sure. How about Niigata and Ryukyu in third and fourth in the table? I'm not really aware of them bringing in. I know Ryukyu made one or two moves, but I can't remember the details. But Niigata pretty quiet.
Yeah, Niigata pretty quiet. Ryukyu brought in a couple of good players actually. Takashi Kanai from S-Pulse, Kofu. I know he played for both of them. I think he came in from Shimizu S-Pulse. Who defender? Let's be honest, they need defenders. They've got a big injury list as well, which I didn't really realize until this week when I was prepping for this. And I think that bringing in Kanai is a good move. In an ideal world, they'd bring in another defender as well. But they've also brought in Hidetoshi, I nearly said Nakata then, Takeda from Urawa, who's a really, really promising midfielder. And I think both of those signings are very good signings. Whether they're enough to mitigate their injury crisis, I don't know how long certain players are out for. But yeah, Riku have done some good business. Niigata haven't, as far as I'm aware, they haven't really done anything. Monteru Yamagata have brought in Ryonosuke, because that's an odd name. It's usually Ryunosuke, but Ryonosuke Kabayama from Yokohama F. Marinos. Really exciting winger. Very raw, but very kind of naturally talented and naturally skillful. Bags of ability. He'll be really exciting to see how he develops under Klamovsky in a very kind of attack-minded Monteru Yamagata setup there. There's also rumors, I'm just trying to find them where I am, rumors about a Thai player coming in, a good Thai player as well. I'm going to completely butcher this name. Jaronasek Vongorn. Oh, yeah, you know him. But he plays at Samut Prakan, which is the club that Masatoshi Ishii is in charge of. And Yuto Ono is the midfielder there. I think there's also another Japanese player, Daisuke Sakai, possibly. And so I've heard him linked with a number of teams, actually. And there'll be no lack of Japanese language information coming from Samut Prakan just because of the contingent there. If he comes in, I think it's an exciting move for the league in and of itself, but it shows that Monteru can be kind of big players in this second half of the season. So I think that Yamagata have done good business. I think Ryukyu have done good business. Yeah, Kofu and Niigata have been pretty quiet. And that's how I'd see it at the moment.
Yeah, good analysis. I agree. And I'm still not sure. This is another thing that happens to me every year, and annoyingly it's happened again, where there's a press release from the J League in like March about the dates for the transfer window when it opens and closes, and then that gets buried on their kind of on the J League homepage. And for some reason I can never find it again. Do you know off the top of your head when the window actually closes, or is it still going until?
Well, it doesn't close, does it? It slams shut. So let's get the terminology right. No, I don't know. Actually, I know the registrations opened on July 17th, I think.
Okay. So we've probably still got another couple of weeks of this kind of fervent transfer talk to go. Okay.
One hopes so.
All right. Okay. And what about at the bottom, where we teams might have a bit more, shall we say, imperative to strengthen because they've been sort of arsing around and embarrassing themselves for the first 23 games. Any good moves that you spotted?
I'm sure you're going to talk about Omiya, so I'll go with Ehime, who I think we've already joked on this podcast already about their horrific defense. But they brought in Naoki Kurayama from Monteru Yamagata, centre-back who, you know, should give them a decent kind of presence there. Because if there's one thing that Ehime looked like they haven't had, it's like an imposing presence. I mean, Yota Akimoto can scream and shout all he wants, but he doesn't look like a very good goalkeeper these days. And so they need someone or something to kind of, to show them that, show them how to stand up and be counted, so to speak. So I think that was a decent signing for them. And what do you think about Omiya bringing in Atsushi Kawata, good player, we know that, and goalkeeper Yuta Minami from Yokohama FC? What do you think?
It's strange. I think we had saw a comment from Steve Baum, formerly Agent Orange on Twitter. He was saying that the bringing in a sort of veteran goalkeeper in the form of Yuta Minami is nothing to worry about, because he can kind of help to coach the younger keepers, I suppose. But yeah, I'm not sure how old he is. Is he 38?
Minami, he's 41.
He's 41. Okay, yeah. So he's no spring chicken. And I'm not sure how much game time he's had for Yokohama FC this season. I'm on Omiya's top team on the official website. I'm looking at the score now. They have 7 registered goalkeepers in the top team at the moment. Obviously, Filip Klajic is out with a long-term knee ligament injury, so they're picking from 6 three of whom look extremely fresh-faced and look more likely to, you know, serve me a beer in a convenience store than, you know, come and claim across under pressure in the J League. But Minami, I mean, he's not going to play, is he?
I think he'll absolutely play. I don't think you bring him in otherwise. Omiya's defending at certain points of this year has been pretty shambolic. And that's not to say that their defensive record is so bad, because it's not. They've got, middle of the pack, conceded 30 goals this year. It's not great, but it's not ultra terrible. But I think that Yuta Minami coming in on loan, I don't think you bring in a lone goalkeeper unless he plays. That would be my view.
It would be very interesting to see what the who does get the nod for the first game back, you know, in early August, won't it? I think that the signing of Atsushi Kawata, that's more of a no brainer, isn't it? He's a proven J2 goal scorer. I don't see any, if he's available, I think taking him makes perfect sense. I do wonder a little bit where that leaves Iba, whether they will play together. I don't think they will, so I think that means that, you know, the manager has to pick one. I think it's also possible that Nermin Haskic, who has looked good in flashes but hasn't really done it, I don't think it's fair to say, consistently enough, that I think he may well leave. Now, there's rumours linking him with a move to a second division team in Turkey, I think. So he might be... basically, I think now, in a similar way to them, seven goalkeepers seems like a lot. There are now nine forwards on their squad sure. page. And I'm not sure, again, we've been over this, Matt, I'm not good at maths, but they haven't scored that many between them this season, just looking, you know, just doing the arithmetic in my head. So I think Atsushi Kawata will probably get a run out fairly soon. And that means that there's... I don't think him and Iba play together. So I think there's a decision for the manager. And I'm not sure about Haskic, where he fits in either. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. I think one sort of big name forward signing we should mention is at Tochigi, isn't it? Where Yohei yes. Toyoda has come in. Big boy up front. So, what do you make of that sign? I was pretty positive about it. I know the reaction on Twitter was mixed.
Well, it's just more of the beautiful game to be played in Tochigi, right? It's ball on the floor, passing on the deck, through balls, one touch, tiki taka. You're not going to see that from Tochigi, but then you never have, really. I think opposition defenders. But the thing is, you know what's going to come. You got Kisho Yano and Yohei Toyoda in your front line, or in the opposition front line. You generally know that the ball's going to get played down the flanks and you're going to have to deal with a certain aerial bombardment. So defenses will know about that, but it's because Toyoda is still a good player, and you have to wonder, like, how centre-backs at this level, and especially centre-backs for teams at the bottom of the table, how are they going to deal with that? So I think it's a big name signing, but also I think it's a relatively decent signing in as much as that he fits the mould of what Tochigi want to do. So good for him.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that they've had, I didn't think Juninho would get so much game time up front for Tochigi, but I think they've been in a situation where they're just short of options. So I think this is kind of similar to the Kawata situation. If a player like Toyoda is available, who is literally ready made to fit into your system, it would be rude not to sign them, wouldn't it? If the chance comes up, I think on Tochigi, they only had four wins from the first 23 games, right? So they've got to improve on that. I know their form is also pretty terrible, isn't it? Four defeats and a draw from the last five going into this kind of mini Olympic break. So anything that can help to arrest that, I think that there's a chance they've got to take. I know Toyoda played, didn't he, in the last game before the break and didn't score. But like you said, it's they're one of the teams where when you concede a corner kick against Tochigi, it's a problem, because they also have, is it Yanagi? Yasutaka Yanagi, who is not a bad option at set pieces either. So all good artillery for them. And yet, what about Serginho coming back at Matsumoto? This reminded me of, from time to time, I am tasked by Mrs. John to go to the supermarket and get unfamiliar items, and I'm always really pleased if I can get the exact brand, the exact packaging that I was asked to, you know. It's not good enough for me to just get like udon noodles. Yeah. I want the exact ones that she normally gets, even though I've got no idea as to where they are. She's not bothered. As long as I get the noodles, it's fine. But for me, it's important for me to get the exact ones. And I think Serginho, it's like, you can imagine Nanami saying, I need someone like Serginho. And then, you know, the knock at the door or the phone call, like, did you get someone like, oh no, sorry, we couldn't get anyone. But that's because we got the exact one. You know, we got the one you wanted. It's the same one. So isn't it a bit of a weird, they say never go back, don't they, Stu? What do you think?
It's an odd one. Like, Daegu, obviously a good side. I think they're in the Asian Champions League quarterfinals, but he didn't really crack that squad. And so, yeah, I mean, it is an odd one. It makes sense in a lot of ways. Maybe he wanted to come back. It gives Matsumoto a little bit of a fillip, but it's not... I mean, they haven't scored enough goals, so he will help with that, but they need to sort that defence out, and Serginho doesn't do that. In fact, Serginho makes it worse, because he just wanders around the edge of his own penalty area, hacking people down, and Nanami will just have to say, look, get your ass up the field and stay away from your own penalty area. He will provide goals, he'll score goals, but they need to sort that defence out first.
I think Serginho is an interesting case because he's proven quality, isn't he, at J2 level, but I think, is he 31?
He is 31.
I am not sure, I don't follow the K-League at all, so I'm not sure how many minutes he's had at Daegu in that last sort of, four or five months since leaving. So I'm just wondering what kind of condition he's going to be in, you know, when he turns up. And I suppose, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but Kazuma Yamaguchi must be close to at least, you know, training or being on the bench.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so they might have two, if you want to be simplistic about it, flair players to choose from, but neither of whom is in optimum condition. You know, neither of them's going to be match fit, probably when the season... When the season resumes. So, yeah, interesting. I think it's if a player like Serginho is available, you can get them in. You have to do it, especially if you are, you know, sixth or seventh bottom of the division. But I don't think it's I agree with you, it's not a magic bullet. I think we were talking a little bit before we started recording. We've watched a lot of Matsumoto, and even if it's only highlights, they've been pretty underwhelming this year, to say the least. And it's at the back, isn't it, where they have a lot of problems. So even if Serginho and Kazuma Yamaguchi turned up fully fit and sharp and raring to go, I still think that leaves a lot of question marks in the defence. All right, Stuart, I think we've rubbished enough teams and players for this part of the show. Should we, unless there's any other transfers you want to mention, should we take a quick break and then we'll come back and
break.
Yeah, let's talk about what we think is going to happen very broadly, and vaguely, so we don't look silly in the second half of the season. And we'll talk about Tokyo Verde a little bit as well. Hi everyone, welcome back to JTET. Stu and I have had a quick break for refreshments, and what we're going to do now is just to talk about very broadly what we think we're going to see in the second half, if you like, of the J2 season coming up, a quick bit of sort of soapboxy stuff about Tokyo Verde before we finish. So, Stu, we still have maybe 10 or so days before J2 action resumes. What should we look out for between now and the end of the season, at the top or the bottom? Is there anything in particular you think we should be focused on?
I think there is. And I think, luckily for people who watch J2, it's going to come on a regular basis. And I think it's going to be the six-pointers that crop up with alarming regularity in the second half of the season. Like, just to give you an example, when we come back from the Olympic break in J2, the first two the first games are on August the 9th, and you have Corfu hosting Iwata, and you have Kyoto hosting Machida. So two kind of promotion kind of six pointers on the go there. And like we've already mentioned, Sagamihara are hosting, are taking on Tochigi SC as well. And you've got Gunma versus Ehime. And I think as you go through the season, particularly at the bottom with the four relegation places, but also at the top, because it's going to be like really compacted, I think there's going to be key games every single week. And I think that can only be good for the league. It can only be good for the excitement. So I think that kind of thing, in a general sense, is kind of where the kind of attraction will lie. I think probably like you, I'm also got my eye on Montero Yamagata. Like, how far can they go? Like, how long can they keep this run, this incredible run going? And like I mentioned earlier, is this break good or bad for them? That's what I'm interested to see. I mean, their first game back is at home against Jeff United. I mean, literally anything could happen in that game. And so, yeah, I think the fact that the teams are playing each other with a lot of things riding on it is going to be good week in, week out. And then, yeah, Montero Yamagata, like how much can they keep their good form going? I think those will be very, very interesting points as well. What about you, John? What do you think? What are you looking forward to in the second half of the season?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I think I've got sort of two hats to wear here as a fan, as a punter. The idea of sort of these non-stop bangers is very exciting. As a podcast host who has to try and make sense of it all, it's frankly terrifying. So hopefully you'll help me out with that on a very very regular basis. I don't think I can cope with big games on a sort of constant basis as you trailed there. But yeah, I agree. I think Montero Yamagata, they forced their way into the conversation, I think. And something that you and I have talked about many times is we try to give, or I think when we started doing the pod, we tried to give equal coverage to all teams in a sort of, we tried to be like the BBC, BBC of the J League. And it, when there were 22 teams and two guys with full-time jobs trying to record a podcast, we just have to let the, don't like the word narrative when it comes to football, but we have to just sort of reflect the narrative that's developing in the league, don't we? That means we're talking about Yamagata more than we're talking about Okayama or Kanazawa, for example. And I think that's as it should be. If Okayama were sixth on a run of is it 5 million straight wins now? We'd be talking about them. So yeah, I think for Yamagata, the interesting thing is Vinicius Araujo. I don't know if he's injured or just not involved at all at the moment, or whether he'll even still be at the club. When the season's back in full swing. But Kota Yamada, the guy's been, he's been so good. That Vinicius Araujo is like this forgotten man now. And I think it's very interesting to see if he's injured at the moment, when he comes back, can he be integrated, or is it a case that he's just lost his place now? So they do have that kind of potential ace in the hole, because he was so important to what they were doing last season. But yeah, I think it's going to be interesting at the top and the bottom. I think something I've lamented with many a guest during the first half of the season is not having the playoffs. Although now I'm thinking from my sanity point of view, it's probably a good thing. It means I can focus on this kind of four-team relegation chaos that's going to develop. If I put you on the spot real quick, Stu, I think Kyoto will end up in the top two. I don't know if they'll be first or second, but I just feel Cho Kuije is such a kind of experienced campaigner in the J League in general, particularly at J2 level. He knows what's required. The squad has looked good enough, I think, over the first half of the season. I think they'll do it. I'm not entirely sure who's going to join them. Do you agree with me that Kyoto are looking a pretty solid bet? And who do you think is going to go up with them in those two promotion spots?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think, without wanting to stay on the fence too much, I will say that Kyoto and Jubilo will both finish in the top three. So that that leaves me a little bit of wiggle room. I think maybe I'm a little bit opposite to you then, because I actually think that Jubilo might be a slightly more complete team with the signings that they've made as well, the depth that they have now. I think they can withstand injuries and suspensions and things like that. I think if you put a gun to my head, I think I'd say Jubilo would finish in the top two, just on the balance of the way they're playing at the moment. But I think that those two teams are the gatekeepers. I think whoever finishes above them will go up. I don't have any doubt about that. Like I said, I think if I had to put money on right now, I'd say those two teams will be the top two. If you have actually forced me to say, who do you think will finish in the top two? I'd say Kyoto and Jubilo. But I think there's enough margin for error. And I think there's enough instances of the top teams playing each other to render a little bit of kind of wiggle room in that prediction. And so I think there is space for one more team to make a real good run at it. Now, whether it's Yamagata, whether it's Niigata, Ryukyu, whatever, Nagasaki, Zelvia, whoever, Corfu are going to finish fifth. I think we all know that and we all love that. I think, yeah, there is room for one more, but I'm not sure who that team is going to be.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's interesting that, you know, between us, we can't split Iwata and Kyoto, even just the two of us talking now. So I think, you know, they're the two teams that are averaging more than 2 points a game, right? 48 from 23 matches. Then you've got Niigata bubbling under, who I think could go either way. I think they're the type of team that could go on a run and force their way into the top two, or they could fall away. I know their form's quite patchy at the moment, isn't it? Ryukyu, I think that first 11 has proved they can go toe to toe with anyone. But I still think I'm rehashing tired analysis here, but I think the squad depth is really being tested at the moment. They had a lot of injuries, didn't they? And I'm not sure if playing so many games behind closed doors has helped them. And that's something we should probably mention, the COVID-19 situation in Tokyo and in Okinawa. And indeed, let's be honest, in Japan in general, the numbers are trending in the wrong direction. It's something that could have an impact on, you know, games being played behind closed doors, you know, going forward. For a Gofu, which is what I'm going to try and get going. Yeah, I think they're a bit short. I think they're a bit short of the kind of X factor. I think outside of Jin, they rely a lot on Jin Izumisawa to provide that. And I think they're just, as usual, they're just one or two players short. That's why they finish fifth, I think, instead of second or third every year. So yeah, I'm just sort of just stating facts, really, rather than analysis. Machida, Zelvia and Nagasaki, it's weird, isn't it? They're seventh and eighth, so they're kind of on the outside of the league table. But I think Machida, when they click, is so that's such an impressive mix of like kind of youth and experience that Ranko Popovic has got there. I think they're quite good to watch, so I think they could go higher. Nagasaki have actually done really well to recover from such a terrible start, haven't they? And it's hard to bet against a team that has such good attacking options like Wellington Hat, as I like to call him, and Edgar Junior, Ken Tucker has even come in and scored goals, and I really like the guy that's playing, I think, a left side defence, Hijiri Kato. He's becoming like an assist machine, and it's always the same, like the kind of deep swirling cross. Yes. That nobody seems to be able to deal with. So I think Nagasaki and Machida are going to go higher, but I don't know if they'll have enough to get into the top two. Basically, I'm just rambling here, but I think it's Kyoto and Iwata in the pole position, isn't it? And I think Niigata or Yamagata for me are probably the most likely teams. What about the bottom, Stu? I think, can we agree that Sagamihara have got an almighty struggle to escape relegation, and then who's going to join them, do you think?
Well, like I said earlier, you could shuffle them in a bag and then pick them out at random, and it would have the look of the bottom four. I think that you look at, if there's anything to go on, you look at the teams that have strengthened. And so Omiya have obviously brought in Kawata and Minami, as we said. Matsumoto Yamaguchi have brought in Serginho. You said they've got Kazuma Yamaguchi to come in as well. Yohei Toyoda has gone in at Tochigi. So those are the kind of variables that weren't there in the first half of the season that could impact the second half of the season. But like I said, I'm just not going to be surprised if I see any of those teams in the bottom four. It's just that tightly packed. And yeah, I don't really see kind of, I don't really see any rhyme or reason as to how things will shake out.
Fair enough. I think for me, the kind of standout team is Omiya, because that's the team that has the squad, which should be 11th or 10th, but isn't. I think the other six, maybe you'd argue Matsumoto have performed a bit more poorly than expected. But I think, to be honest, in our pre-season preview and what other guests, you know, pundits have been on, have said that nobody's that surprised to see Matsumoto slumming it in 16th. But I think Omiya being second bottom with 3 wins from 23 matches, that is the one that kind of, you know, if you'd been blasted into space for 6 months and then, you know, come back from the ISS and picked up a copy of El Golazo, you'd be like, what's happened here? You know, so yeah, that's the one I think that, for me, that's the really interesting one, because there's absolutely no way Omiya should be going down. And I do think they'll get out of it, but they've given themselves a lot to do, haven't they, shall we say?
Hmm.
Okay, Stu, this is all good optimistic stuff, but I think the listeners probably expect us to end on a downer. So let's talk about, I know one transfer we didn't mention was at Tokyo Vigi. Ryuji Sugimoto has gone back, hasn't he? Former Verdy youth team product. So it'd be interesting to see him do nothing for 5 games, then bang in an absolute thunder bastard, you know, in the sixth game, then go back to doing nothing like he did for Tokushima. But yeah, that's not the big news coming out of Tokyo Verde, is it? This week, today. Yeah. So what's been going down?
What's been going down? So today, I think it was reported from one of the tabloid papers that was picked up by Livedoor, which in Japan is like a news aggregation service or something along those lines, and it was basically about what's been going on behind the scenes at Tokyo Verde in relation to their boss Hideki Nagai's management techniques. The article, it's all in Japanese. I retweeted it earlier with just like some bullet points of what the article went through. But basically what you're looking at is a list of kind of accusations that have been put at him by anonymous players who obviously have their own agendas, but amongst the complaints from players is that one player was asked to continue in a game where he was quite clearly injured. The player we believe is Ryoya Yamashita, who was injured in the game at in their home game against Jubilo Iwata. I think it turned out that he broke a bone in his arm, but Nagai told him to play on and he needed to show heart. Which is, it's an odd way of motivating your players, I would guess. Other things include unnecessary targeting of players in analysis sessions. So, again, one of the stories in the article was that one player was singled out who was in a game. He was brought off at halftime, and then the following day in training, he was made to watch a 30-minute low-light video along with the rest of the squad while Nagai pointed out every single one of his mistakes. And apparently that goes on quite a lot. There's rumours of kind of morale being very low with certain members of the squad, and that Nagai punishing them for no particular reason. The defender, I think it Ryota Narawa, is named in the article as being very unhappy with some of Nagai's methods. In fact, I think he's quoted as saying, I'm not sure if it's Narao actually, it might be someone else, who's quoted as saying he'd rather retire than play for Nagai again. And there's unhappiness with his training methods. He says one of the complaints is that Nagai has 1 hour meetings before training, which I don't know. I assume that's not normal. I don't think that is normal, but I suppose each player or each manager has their own style. One player said that Nagai does training sessions that Marcelo Bielsa does at Leeds and that Pep Guardiola does at Manchester City. But obviously the players aren't good enough to do those kind of things that Bielsa and Guardiola have at their disposal can. So there's a litany of complaints, and I think that the most depressing one is the kind of the forcing injured players to play or to carry on, because in this day and age that shouldn't really happen. That's a throwback to probably not just Japanese culture of gaman, like do your best or just keep going. But you know, that's about showing toughness in the face of adversity. But that's just an outdated notion now. An outdated notion. It's just a terrible way to look after your prize assets. It wouldn't surprise me if this article triggered an investigation within the club into Hideki Nagai's methods and what he says and what he does to players. The bar has already been set, basically, because Chokije was placed on administrative leave and then sacked for doing something relatively similar sounding at Shonan Bellmare. One of the interesting things about Chokije is that he's arguably landed in a far better situation now than when he was.
Don't do it again. Go and manage the bigger club with more money.
Precisely. But I think, yeah, those are the main points about what Nagai has been accused of. Yeah, I wonder what you think. Like, I think personally, there's always going to be a little bit of a gray zone between like what one person says has happened to him and what the other person thought about the situation. And yeah, I think you've got some kind of more articulate thoughts on that than I have.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure. I think, yeah, well, first of all, let's unpack this. I think for Hideki Nagai, this looks very bad.
Mm.
And I don't think, again, just based on the one article, and also we should say deafening silence from Tokyo Verde officially, no statement on the club website acknowledging this, denying this yet, whether that's because they have to go through numerous sort of corporate channels, PR channels, to actually get a statement out there, or what I personally think is more like is they can't just issue a kind of blanket denial because some of this stuff is actually true and they're trying to work out what they can deny and what they can't and how they can word it. I think it looks very bad for him. And I don't really see any way back for him. If the club can't come out and give a kind of blanket denial, this is all rubbish kind of thing. I think he's in big trouble, as you mentioned. Japan as a society has a slightly different definition of harassment and power harassment, bullying than I'm familiar with from where I grew up. And obviously we both grew up in the UK, so maybe you'd agree with me on that, Stu. But I think as well, we're in a professional sports environment. Some things happen there that don't happen in like my office, for example. So again, there's a grey zone, there's a line, but you're right, forcing people to play when they're injured is over that line. And I would argue that calling players out for a full 30 minutes in front of the rest of the squad is probably over a line as well. And I just don't really think, I'm not sure there's any way back for a manager in that situation. The wider point I wanted to make is I'm pretty sure there are unhappy players in the locker rooms up and down the J League. In fact, I'd be very surprised if in a squad. I mean, geez, I've just talked about Omiya's squad has got like 56 players in it. You know, I mean, that means maths again. was minus 11. A lot of them should be banging on the manager's door on a Monday morning asking why they weren't playing or they weren't in the squad or whatever. So it's always interesting for me when what makes it out into the media and what doesn't. And I think the timing of these revelations, if you like, is quite interesting because I think the real Yamashita incident we're referring to was back in May when he broke a bone in his arm and was wanted to come off but was forced to play on. So we know that's 2 months. We're 2 months, almost 3 months removed from that. I wonder why these stories are sort of breaking cover right now. Whether that's a conscious decision by the players to get the stories out there, or the journalist in question was just waiting for multiple sources to make sure that they could go ahead, and publish what they wanted to publish. But it's interesting that if I was a player and I broke a bone in my arm, we're not talking about like an ankle sprain or a broken fingernail or something. It's a serious business. I would have been texting at my preferred journalist, like on the team bus after that game, to say, I want you to report this. So it's interesting the timing of these things, whether it's anything to do with the kind of mini break that we're on at the moment, whether the players think they might be able to force like a manager change or something. I don't know. I think that's flawed because obviously, like you said, there'll be some kind of investigation internally at Tokyo Verde. The J-League themselves might even get involved. So I don't think it's going to be cut and dried. But I think bottom line, I think this probably happens at a lot of clubs. I don't think that makes it right. I think it's very wrong. But I think Nagai, I don't see how a team in ninth place with a pretty average record, I don't see how a coach, even if he is a playing legend at Verde, I think he'll do very well if he can keep his job after this. But we'll wait and see. We should say a lot of this stuff is unsubstantiated, but doesn't look good, does it, on the face of it?
No, that's the thing as well. I think you make a good point about kind of Verde haven't said anything, and that's because either they won't or they can't. And both those look as bad as each other, to be quite frank. But the fact that they haven't come out and said, this is just one person's view, or we don't believe that the incident happened the way it was explained in the article. I think those kind of things would kind of just put dampeners on the story for a little bit. But I don't see, now that these allegations are out there, I don't see how they are not investigated. There's a double negative there, but I think we'll let that slide. I think that they have to be looked at. And I think if they're anything like what Choki J had to step down for, then I don't think Nagai's going to have any choice in the matter, to be perfectly blunt. I think one of the strands that the article writer went for was that he's kind of bringing the name of Verde into disrepute. So I think you mentioned in the article, it said something like the club of King Kazu and Rui Ramos and Nobuyuki Takeda, the name of the glorious club of Japan is being brought into disrepute with allegations of bullying or harassment or like those kind of things. Verde haven't been like a symbolic club for a long time, but they are still a recognizable name. And I think Nagai would do well to come out and say something like, I'm a hard coach. If people have taken that the wrong way, then I apologize, but that's just the way I do my job. Then he can get it out on record. The strange fact is that Verde are ninth. They're not in any relegation trouble, even though they look like they might be early on in the season. They're relatively safe as it stands right now. It doesn't seem to have affected their, because they've only just finished like a 5-match winning run. And so that's the odd thing about it. And I think there's a lot to unpack, and I don't think we'll actually get to the bottom of the story until Verde decide, or if Verde decide to do an investigation, or if they just decide to say, until substantiated claims are made against us, we're not going to do anything. So I think it's a very much holding pattern. But because there's no games, obviously most people will have their eye on the Olympic Games, but because there are no J-League games, there's not a lot else to take the the oxygen away from this story. Because if they, for example, if this story came out and then they went out and beat Jubilo at a 5-0, then the story you'd think would be put on the back burner for a little bit, but there isn't that, they don't have that luxury now. And so it's just, yeah, it's an odd one, but it's slightly depressing. If it's true, if these claims are true, then it is slightly depressing. And yeah, Nagai will do well to keep hold of his job, I would say.
Yeah, I think the one reason you mentioned a couple of times about Verdi conducting some kind of internal investigation, I think that's a given. I think that will definitely happen. And I think the reason is probably there's one specific strand of this which we should heavily stress. And this is players being forced to continue when they want to come off because they've broken a bone. I don't know what the league protocols are on this, but where is the team doctor in that? You know, the physio. You know, why is the coach allowed to make that call? How can he overrule? I mean, did the doctor said this player's broken a bone and needs to come off, or did the doctor say this player's broken a bone but he can carry on if you want him to? Like, I would like to know the specifics, because you and I have bored the listeners before with our views on, you know, concussion protocols, for example, and how we don't think they should be. You know, that decision shouldn't be taken by the player who might be concussed, and it shouldn't be taken by a doctor who's on, you know, paid by the team.
So I'll read a direct quote. I say direct quote, I'm translating from Japanese here from the article. This is the journalist who's written this. He said, in the match against Jubilo Iwata on May the 23rd, Ryoya Yamashita, who broke a bone in his left arm during the match, had to continue and said after the game, I ran for 90 minutes in severe pain. But Nagai said, everyone must fight with the same amount of passion. And apparently this quote was criticized by Tokyo Verdy supporters. I didn't hear anything or see anything about that. But then I only watched the highlights of that game. And I remember Yuto Suzuki scoring a good goal in that game, which Jubilo won 2-0. I didn't see any of that. But I think that kind of mentality just harks back to like an old man coaching a young boys team, just like trying to live vicariously through them. Just like, oh, look, if it was me, I'd carry on. But it's just that in and of itself. And I think you make a good point about the doctors and things like that. Like, again, whether Yamashita thought that he had to play on with it. I don't know the full ins and outs of this, because it's not very clear in the article. I don't know if, for example, Verdi had used all their subs if and when it happened. I don't know if it's just like, if he comes off, it's going to be, but they were losing from half time. So I don't really kind of understand that, but still he broke a bone in his arm. No, I was just going to say, it's different from breaking your arm, but at the same time, it must be pretty easy for a doctor to, if not diagnose a break, be pretty certain that something's not correct in the physiological makeup of the arm. And so, yeah, whether there's a lot of things like, did Yamashita want to play? Did he want to play? And did he not want to let his team down? Did he feel forced to? Because if he came off, he wouldn't play the next game, or those kind of things. There's a lot to kind of root down to get to the bottom of. This kind of like the, I don't know, it's like the pot noodle of journalism. There's enough there, but there's not enough to satisfy the hunger, if that makes sense. Like, it just needs more depth. I'm not just talking about pot noodles, but like, I'm talking about the story.
Well, I'm hesitant to segue from pot noodles to Christian Eriksen, but obviously, you know, we're only a month or so away from him collapsing, you know, on the pitch in a game. Now, that was a freak thing that nobody saw coming. He didn't feel unwell, you know, or anything in advance. But I think we have to be at the point where players should be able to say, I don't feel, it could be literally, I don't feel very well. I want to come off. And I don't think the manager should be able to say, no, you can't come off. I think they should just be, that they, I would already be halfway down the tunnel at that point, you know. It's a strange one. I mean, you and I have jobs, you know, if we're not very well, we go home, you know, and we rest, you know, especially during a global pandemic, you know. So I just think the whole thing is very bad. Verdi have had a lot of bad publicity already early on this season with their kind of a hostile takeover from Zabio, which was very very poorly done very publicly, you know, with like sponsors, you know, trashing the Zabio on Twitter, for example. I take your point. I think Verdi is obviously not the sort of Japan's number one club of the past, but there are people working there in their media department, marketing, but working very hard to make it a viable sort of, you know, going concern, even with the odds kind of stacked against them a lot of the time. And this kind of stuff just doesn't help. And I just kind of, in a lot of ways, I just feel annoyed on behalf of supporters and people at the club who are kind of, they are pulling in the same direction. This kind of thing's just not helpful at all, is it? And it looks bad. We'll wait to see. I have a feeling we might be talking about this again before too long, because I think Verdi will have to say something. I'm kind of surprised they haven't even got a sort of generic statement on their website already, like, we're aware of this, we're looking into it or something.
Well, I'll be, just to wrap this up, I'll retweet this later, but I've just found photographs of Ryoya Yamashita's arm being kind of plastered up in the game against Jubilo. So, that's interesting.
Well, I think on that note, Stu, we'd probably better leave this special kind of summer break episode here before it gets any darker. But on the subject of power harassment, that week when you had your wisdom teeth taken out, I remember saying we could record later if you wanted to. So don't be
thoughtful.
Yeah, don't be me tooing me in these pictures of Ryo Yamashita's plastic cast. Okay, no, that's all in jest, obviously. Yeah, we're not unionized here, are we? But we don't make people work when they're not very well. So okay, well, Stu, talking of not being very well, it's pretty late, so we should probably leave it here for now. I think there's more JTech content coming before J2 comes back. I think possibly another kind of special, or we'll do something maybe with a guest to keep things ticking over. But for now, please enjoy the rest of the Olympics if you can, and look forward to J2 coming back. Thanks for listening and downloading. We appreciate that. And if you support the JTalk podcast on Patreon, of course, we appreciate that a great deal as well. So, Stu, thanks for your time. It was good to talk to you again after a while.
Yeah, good to talk to you as well. It was too long. So let's do it again sometime soon.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay. Thanks again, Stu. Thanks for listening, everyone. Enjoy your football, and we'll speak soon. Bye for now.